Okay, so I'm gonna present you a work that whose goal was actually to trying to understand the cosmic star formation history. So by that term, I mean the average star formation rate in the universe, the so-called Madaw plot. And I mean the question is, I mean, how do you compute this Madaw plot? Of course, using numerical simulation, but I mean, if we want to understand more deeply what is the origin of the star formation history in the universe, what comes out, and I'm going to try to convince you, is that the diffuse accretion, I mean the accretion on you know the intergalactic medium onto star-forming galaxies, is the main, the first and most important component. The background is actually, of course, the hierarchical model of structure formation, where you basically start from a well-known initial condition, and based on gravitational instability alone, you form clumps within a filamentary structure called the cosmic web, and you want to actually compare this structure with the distribution of galaxies observed today, and hopefully you want also to compare the internal structure of the galaxies. Their colors, is there a spiral, is there a bulge, all these questions. So how do you address this using cosmological simulation? So this is basically the, I would say, the minimal ingredient you need in order to form galaxies and compare to galaxies you have around us today. I mean, by minimal, I mean that you can, of course, consider a much more complex phenomenon, but in order to have any meaningful result, you need at least to consider cooling, UV heating by UV background. Those are two important ingredients. Then, as soon as you form very dense disks, you need to do something with those disks. So you can either follow the collapse indefinitely, as you just saw, or you can actually assume that those disks are filled up with the interstellar medium, which we describe usually using subgrid physics. So the state-of-the-art approach now is to use a polytrope equation of state that somehow mimic the effective equation of state in the interstellar medium. Of course, it is poorly known, so this is considered as a free parameter. Then within this interstellar medium, we form star. That's the second subgrid physics ingredient. Again, within this ISM, we make supernovae explode within blast waves that hopefully give some feedback into the IGM. So there are some subtleties that are necessary, but that are very difficult to address using cosmological simulation. The most important thing that lacks in our modeling is starburst. So we don't have the resolution, actually, in cosmological simulation to follow the collapse of very tiny regions that might result in starburst. So most of the time, we don't have starburst in our simulation. And actually, you observe starburst all over the place in the universe. So this is, for example, M82, where you see a galactic wind, which is due to supernova feedback. But these winds actually are driven by starburst. So this is really a missing part in the overall model. So there are, of course, many problems of this hierarchical model for galaxy formation. Overcooling, we form way too many baryons in the dense phase. Dense phase meaning cold gas plus stars. We have the angular momentum problem, meaning that the galaxies are too small. They don't have enough angular momentum at large radii, too much mass in the bulge, and the so-called missing satellite problem. So the galaxy we observe in the universe have fewer satellites than it might be the case in the model. So all these are issues which we are trying to solve. There are also numerical issues, of course, that might partially explain the physical issues, and the next generation of cosmological model might maybe address new ingredients like, as I said, starburst, AGN, and maybe MHD. So let's very quickly summarize the main ingredient here, which is the ISM modeling, or what we call subgrid physics. And so the most important part of it is the star formation. So we basically try to mimic Kennicott law, which is here expressed as a typical surface density, star formation surface density versus gas surface density. And so the two things that comes out of this approach is that basically you have a threshold density above which we form star, and we have a star formation efficiency, which we parameterize by this T0, which is a typical time scale, at the threshold density. So if you consider T0 equal 10 GigaHair, this gives you an efficiency, which is maybe more useful to consider, of 2%. And numerically, we implement this using a very simple approach, basically to spawn star particles, which are collisionless. And there is a very important caveat here, is that because of the polytrop, because we don't resolve the vertical structure of the disks, our disks are very smooth. We don't have, a giant point of color cloud in it, and they are poorly resolved. So these stars are more, like a stochastic star formation within very smooth disks. So our disks are not very realistic in this respect. But we do form stars within the disk at a rate consistent with observation, at least with local observation. So winds. So as I said,
why do that? Why don't you have a density threshold?
We have a density threshold. Actually, the density threshold. So we basically define star forming region above density threshold, which is kind of fitted to the surface density threshold of the Kennicott law. Okay. So now winds. So as I said, we implement supernova blast wave in the code, which are supposed to mimic super bubbles, which are 100, 200 parsec large. And when you do that in those, thick quiescent disks, what we obtain basically is that the wind efficiency, so this is a typical metallicity map of a wind escaping a very low mass galaxy here. So you see the galactic plane here and the wind structure here. And those, if you compute the star formation rate in this galaxy, which goes from one solar mass per year to one-tenth solar mass per year, and you compare this to the wind outflow rate in the same units, you see that the wind efficiency defined as the wind outflow rate to the stellar star formation rate is very low, roughly 10%. So, within this modeling, without starburst, we get very inefficient wind. So that's one very important point to have in mind. So now let's go in more details into the model to understand star formation history in the universe. So one important ingredient, as I said, was that the universe there is a UV background, and this UV background heat up the gas to quite large temperature after ionization. And actually, the pressure support of this gas prevents gas from collapsing into the lowest mass dark matter halo. So this is something which can be interpreted as a Jeans mass, although it's more subtle than that. So it's usually termed as a filtering mass. So this filtering mass defines the mass below which baryon cannot fall into the dark matter halo. And so if now you also ask for this baryon to be able to cool down and form a disk, you have a definition of what we call star-forming halos, meaning halos, dark matter halos, that contain a star-forming disk. And this is this minimal mass here, which is plotted as a function of redshift. So at very early time, this minimal mass is around 10 to the 7 solar mass. And then when reionization kicks in, this minimal mass increases with time. And today, it's around 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11. So of course, this is a very simple analytical model. And when you compare to the numerical simulation, this basically is roughly reproduced with, as you can see, factors of 10 here, because it's quite a complex quantity to compute. But this minimal mass actually is the mass that defines, below this mass, you define the diffuse background. So dark matter halo does not contain collapsed gas, so the gas is in the diffuse form, okay? And above this mass, you have clumpy halos, where the gas is clumpy, dense, and star-forming, okay? So, if you do have the statistic of dark matter halo using the Presch-Schechter formalism, so this is a very simple statistical tool, you have here the fraction of mass as a function of halo mass. So if you take the minimal mass at z equals 0, for example, tells you that below this mass, all dark matter halo contains diffuse baryons. And above this mass, dark matter halo contains clumpy star-forming baryons. So you can actually compute the diffuse gas accretion by taking the derivative of the Presch-Schechter mass function above the minimal mass, and this gives you, very simply, it's a very simple formula, the mass accretion rate of the diffuse gas component onto star-forming halos. And this is the main ingredient in computing the star formation rate I was going to see there.
Are you guaranteed there is an accretion? Because it looks like, I mean, there's computation. The minimum mass is going up as you approach the present, but the typical halo mass is also going up.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Are you guaranteed that, you know, it's always accretion and not, you know,
you have actually some possible strong evolution of the minimal mass that can give you non-accretion anymore. But using a reasonable evolution of the minimal mass, you get, as I will show you, always accretion.
Okay.
So now, let's have a look at the typical numerical simulation result. So this is a H-1 megaparsec box here, with dark matter, gas temperature, gas density, and star density. So each frame from left to right is a zoom into the central region. So you see that these two very large dark matter halo contains a very large disk in the center. So this is cold disks, rotating disks, with very dense material, where actually we form star. And you see the star here that forms, which are, you know, looking like rather thick disks. So as you see, the resolution is rather poor in those disks, so we don't resolve at all the vertical structure. But these are described by a polytrope, which allow the Jeans mass to be artificially resolved because of the polytrope, but we don't resolve internal, you know, GMCs or whatever where star form. So it's a very crude approximation at the smaller scales, but we capture the large scale filamentary structure that is actually feeding those disks. So we can actually capture the main baryon phases which enter in the game. So here we have the diffuse background, which is warm, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5K, underdense with filaments. Then we have the hot halos here, which you see here as hot clumps. And those hot halos contain tiny, dense disks, which define the third phase, the dense gaseous disks. So we have three phases, the diffuse background, the hot halos, and within those hot halos, the dense disks. So actually, if you look more quantitatively in the density and temperature plane of the same simulation, you see that the diffuse background sits here at the low density part. The hot halo sit here at intermediate density and quite high temperature. And the dense disks sit here at the highest density part. And they are 10 to the 4K cold. So this is where star formation proceeds. So all these four phases, so IGM, hot gas, cold disk, and stars, can actually evolve. And you can compute the budget, the evolution of the mass within these four phases using the Preisschachter statistic as the single tool. And you can design a very simple, of course, oversimplified analytical model using these Preisschachter statistics and various semi-analytical approximations. And you have to solve basically these four differential equations that gives the evolution of the background mass, hot gas mass, cold gas mass, and star mass. And you have basically accretion that goes from the diffuse component to the halos, cooling that goes from the halo to the disks, and galactic winds that remove disk gas from the disks and put it back in the background. So if you come up, because the cooling is so fast that the statistic is very low.
What's the spatial resolution?
For this simulation,
yeah.
I'm going to give more details in a couple of slides. So so you see that these pictures of hierarchical clustering. So at each time, you have a lot of progenitors of small mass at the beginning that come together in order to form larger progenitors and eventually end up in the final halo. And at each time, you solve this evolution and you can compute the evolution of various baryon phases. So what is the prediction of this very simple model? I mean, we are focusing here only on the star formation rate. So you see here the Madao plot. So that's the star formation rate, the co-moving star formation rate as a function of redshift. And there is so the solid line here is very interesting because we have assumed here that the time scale for the Kennicott law inside the disk is zero. So it's for a very, very efficient star formation very high star formation efficiency in the disks. And you see that in this case, you're actually limited only by gas accretion. And here, you don't have clumpy gas accretion because as soon as you have clumpy gas, it's automatically immediately transformed into stars. So actually, this curve here is controlled only by diffuse gas accretion. And the nice thing with this curve is that it only depends on cosmology and atomic physics. So, I mean, to first order, you can say that the star formation in the universe is only controlled by the cosmological parameters and the minimal mass that defines your background. So now, if you increase the star formation efficiency, if you decrease the star formation efficiency, so you increase the T-star parameter, then you basically put a delay in the curve, and star formation is slightly translated to the left because you have a delay between the accretion and star formation. And this delay is actually given and controlled by this star formation parameter. So if you want a typical Kennicott with a typical efficiency of the Kennicott law, this gives you T star at 3 GigaHair in our notation. And this is basically this curve. Okay? So the interesting thing is that the main impact on this curve is diffuse gas accretion and cosmological evolution. Now if you look, so let's take this typical Kennicott prediction here, this is a solid line here, and now we progressively increase the size of the wind. You see that you basically remove some star formation here, and you put the peak at a higher resolution. So with these two parameters, you can actually somehow...
What's the wind efficiency on the left?
Here. This
no.
one.
No, no.
I'm sorry.
The
eta parameter
on the left, constant size on the left.
It's zero, no winds,
no winds.
No winds, yeah. So you put the winds here on.
Okay.
So just to say that this analytical model works well when compared to numerical simulation. So this is a numerical simulation with increasing mass resolution, and it's a 10 megaparsec box. And you see that the predicted star formation history by the analytical model for each resolution is the line, and the measured star formation rate in the simulation are the symbols. And as you see, as you increase the resolution, basically, so if you have a very poor resolution, what happens? A very poor resolution means your minimal mass is artificially higher than the true minimal mass. And so this is how we take into account the finite resolution into our analytical model, by artificially increasing the minimal mass to the minimal halo mass we actually can resolve in the simulation, which is usually 100 particles. And therefore, we have this evolution. So we see that we are slowly converging towards the true value, which is this one. And that...
Sorry, I mean, this number 5 row cube is the number of that particle?
Yeah. Yeah, so typically the number of Gall cells is a factor of 3 or 4 in our simulation.
What's the meaning? What's the size of the lowest level cell?
So actually, you have like 4, 5, 6, and 7 additional level of refinement on top of a Bechdel grid, which is of this number too. Yeah, but I mean, I have another slide that will give you. Okay, so now let's play this interesting game, which is to actually trying to fit or determine those two parameters, star formation efficiency and wind efficiency, on the data. So actually, we have a set of data points here. So now we have a much lower redshift 6, than to 0. And all these are data points which were compiled by my colleague David Elbal. And this is a model that basically goes through the points. And that was actually fitted using the procedure I'm going to describe now. So here you have the two parameter plane, T star, which is a typical star formation time scale, and eta wind, the wind efficiency. So if you want to fit the star formation rate at z equals 0 here, then you need the star formation efficiency, which is plotted here, to lie along this line. Okay? So it means that if you have a parameter eta wind, which is related to T star, along this line, you can fit this z equals 0 point. Now, if you pick up a z equals 3 point, let's say this one, then you need to you need to follow this line. Okay, so you see that basically you pick up here an intersection point, which is roughly at the Kennicott efficiency, so this is good, and which is at a wind efficiency of 1, meaning that you need to eject as much gas in the wind as you form star per year. And to my opinion, this is bad because it's difficult, at least for our numerical simulations. On the other hand, that's pretty much what you observe in Lyman-Brick galaxies, as Chuck Schleidel explained the other day. You seem to detect winds which have this efficiency of even higher. So basically, we need very strong driven winds, supernova driven winds, in order to be able to fit the data.
But the wind is basically affected by lower pressure, right? And you are undershifting most of the sample. So I'm not so sure.
No, yeah. I mean, to be really honest, we didn't fit in the usual sense, right? We basically pick only this point and this point, and we.
Right. Actually, you may be better off with your model because you look at the star formation rate, right?
Yeah. So maybe with less wind.
All the points are above the model.
Yeah.
So you actually can allow yourself to have less winds, and then you will want to have.
But when I asked David Elbaz if it was decent to actually do a fit on these points, he said no, because the error bars are very tricky. And so the answer will be will be around this. I agree. I mean you have you can possibly have less strong winds and sit here and then it's okay. Yeah. I agree with you.
Number of
points. When you look at that, you come up, but then the problem is that you come up here too.
Yeah.
So you're gonna.
Yeah, you're
looking at points. No, it's true.
Okay,
yeah.
Volume,
yeah, I agree. So there are room for less efficient winds in the average.
Sorry, I want to make sure I understand that. Are you looking for the intersection of the black and the white?
Yeah, the intersection, so the other curve here and here gives you the level of uncertainty, right? So it's huge, okay?
But
if you intersect the two curves, you roughly pick up this region.
Yeah, but then it means that you're assuming that those two points will be constant relationship and you're very strong assumption.
Oh, of course. The Kennicott normalization here is assumed to be constant in with the redshift.
Even data and both, sure.
That's the assumption of the model. Constant efficiency. If you play with the, you can actually put some redshift dependence of those two parameters in your model, and then you're gonna have a different answer.
Of course. It seems reasonable to assume that the T naught is probably not the temperature. That's going to be set by physics. It's much smaller than a galaxy.
But yeah, not at all.
Right, but for Ada, you might imagine, well, it's easier to eject things from the smaller galaxies. You'll have a higher redshift, and from the bigger galaxies, you'll have.
Right.
Sure.
Well, I would have played it before again, but I suggested I would have gotten the best guess for the transmission time. And play with it as in order to fit at least big redshift and play with it as a functional redshift.
Yeah, but
quite different
game. I agree with you, but we need better data, right?
Yeah, I agree.
And there are also other data I'm not quoting here, the amount of gas in Lyman and Brick galaxies, the amount of gas in them planetary system, and so on and so forth. And you can actually constrain those parameters using these other observational. So this is kind of working okay. Now the bad news. So here is the star formation rate, the star formation history, as a function of flukeback time. But now not for the universe as a whole, but for individual halo mass ranges. So this is the stellar mass. So this is from Sloan, SDSS, and this is the stellar mass here. So you see that here they have computed the average star formation history in typical, I would say, L star kind of galaxy, while here you are going to group and to galaxy clusters. And so what does so here it was for the first time identified what was called an anti-hierarchical or downsizing effect, namely that the largest halos form the stars at early time, okay, while the small mass halo forms stars at all time.
That's stellar masses, it's not.
That's stellar masses, yeah, stellar masses. So you need to multiply by your favorite M over L ratio in order to, or M over M star ratio. And now, with the same analytical model, we can actually compute those quantities. And this is what we get. So you see that this anti-hierarchical behavior is qualitatively recovered. And the reason is actually very simple. If you go back to this, you have this minimal mass here, but you have another important quantity, which is the typical nonlinear mass in the Presch-Schechter mass function. And you see that when you go to higher redshift, the typical nonlinear mass of the Presch-Schechter mass function goes to lower mass. And so for low mass objects, you sit very close to this minimal mass. So the amount of progenitors that are able to form stars at early time for those low mass objects is small, very small. While the amount of progenitor for this high mass object is very large, of course. So you form stars much more efficiently here at early time. And then at later time, the cooling efficiency drops because you have very high virial temperature. And so you see this drop here is because of this cooling efficiency that drops. But okay, qualitatively it's working okay, but quantitatively what you see is that it's not working at all, because here the star formation rate dropped by a factor of 100, while here it's always dropping by a factor of a few. So we have a very strong star formation shutdown in the largest object. So this is a problem because this model doesn't take that into account. And so this is, at the origin of what is called now galaxy bimodality. Basically, those galaxies are typically blue, while those galaxies are typically red. This is due to this very efficient shutdown. Yep.
So you also find in the simulation
no.
that there is too much gas left in those large objects?
Exactly. We see in the simulation that the star formation rate in those large objects is still going on. Therefore, they are too blue. So this problem has been addressed, of course, many times, and there are several possibilities. So the one I'm going to address here is since, as I'm going to show you, there is a bimodality in the diffuse gas accretion, again, this might explain the origin of this bimodality in the star formation history. There are other possibilities here. AGN feedback might be possible too. Maybe you have AGN kicking in here, and that basically remove all the gas which is there, and so star formation is shut down. You have a lot of, it's an industry now to trying to understand this. And AGN is kind of working. So here I'm going to
turn all the magic knobs and dials, the rate settings, AGN works.
Exactly. AGN is a magic knob.
I can wind up behind AGN feedback.
So now I'm going to describe a recent simulation, which was done at the Mare Nostrum, using the Mare Nostrum supercomputer in Barcelona. So this is the Mare Nostrum supercomputer in a nice church. Exactly.
Heavenly inspiration.
And actually, this church was desacralized before installing the computer. So we are not, protected against bugs and stuff like that. But still, it's a nice place to actually do those large simulations. So it's not a.
I can hear that after the church is one of the best nightclubs in Barcelona.
Yeah.
You can go to the church.
And so this is a 4-week simulation. So each week was actually scattered over all the 1 year. So 1 week every trimester. And the simulation is now down to z equal 1.5, and it's over. Typical numbers here. So it's a 50 h minus 1 megaparsec box with 1024 cube dark matter particles and base grid. And in total, we get 4 billion AMR cells at the end of the simulation. We have 5 levels of refinement. And the smallest cell size is 2 kiloparsec physical. So that answers the question. So basically, those large disks are poorly resolved. Okay. But we kind of get some disk-like structures, and which have roughly a size that allow the disk to sit at the very center of the halo. So we have this minimal physics model I just described to you. And actually, this project is a two teams project, one using RAMSIS and one using Gadget. And we are actually simulating exactly the same initial condition with two different codes in order to check, so at the large scale distribution is very similar, of course. The small scale distribution is not at all the same. So we. Not exactly, because in RAMS, in Gadget, they have this very efficient, although weird, wind prescription. They take gas in the disk and they remove it out of the halo, like a quantum tunnel effect. While we basically we make a supernova blast wave explode in the disk. So our wind, as I said, are very inefficient. So because of that, the star formation knobs has to be tuned differently. But the overall star formation history is quite the same. I have some plots. But, so our goal here is, of course, to compare. So I'm going to show you the result concerning diffuse gas accretion. So here again, I will focus only on the diffuse gas accretion and see how it might be the origin of this galaxy bimodality that I discussed earlier. So this is in one slide. I'm going to try to explain what's going on. So now, first this plot. So here, this is a color magnitude diagram of the Sloan galaxies, and you see that there are two branches: the red branch and the blue branch, which is actually the example of galaxy bimodality. So you have red luminous galaxies and those two class of galaxies are separated at a stellar mass, which is, as I said, of the order of 3×10^10 solar mass. Okay, so this is the famous galaxy bimodality. So when you look at a typical 10^12 solar mass halo at Z equal 4 here, and you look at another typical 10^12 solar mass halo at Z equal 2, you see that the gas distribution, the diffuse gas distribution around the central galaxy, which you see here, so I don't know if you see, but there is a disk here, and there is another disk here. You see that the gas distribution, the diffuse gas distribution, is completely different. So here you have filaments. So this is diffuse gas, okay, but in a filamentary structure. And those clumps are the clumpy accretion of satellites. So we don't consider this here, okay. And here you see again some satellites around the central galaxy, but the filaments have disappeared. They are much weaker, and they are. And you see in the gas distribution here, there is a shock here, which go here, while here the shock is barely here. I mean, very close to the galaxy. So these qualitative differences has been actually identified by several people here, and has been proposed to be the origin of this galaxy bimodality. So why is that? I mean, you can say that if you feed the galaxy using these filaments directly to the disk, you can actually have regular or normal star formation occurring in these disks. While if you somehow cut those filaments and all the gas is kept into this hot halo, and there is a big if here, if you manage to make this hot gas not cool and sink into the disk, then you might have a solution to explain the star formation shutdown. If, on the other hand, you feed directly with filament the disk with fresh gas, then you can't have star formation shutdown. So that's the idea that was proposed first by Dekel, and then observed by Andrei in numerical simulation. And then other Keres et al. Analyzed this in SPH simulation. And here, our goal is to analyze this in our AMR simulation.
So why are they disappeared?
So that's here. So basically, the physics, I mean, it's very simplified, but so typically, for a shock to exist, you need the shock to be stable. And Abishai and collaborators actually derived some very simple analytical argument. So if the cooling time at the virial density is of the order of the dynamical time, then the shock actually can survive, is smaller. If the cooling time is smaller than dynamical time, then the shock can survive close to the disk and expand, and you have a hot virialized halo. If, on the other hand, the cooling time is smaller, then it's cooling too much, then the shock will be basically confined close to the disk or even not exist at all. Okay. Now for filament, you have the same kind of approach that applies, except now you use for the density of the filament, you have a density enhancement, which is due to the fact that the filaments are pressure confined, so they are at a lower temperature than the halo, so they are pressure confined, and therefore they have a density enhancement. And so if you apply the same criteria here, you can have filaments surviving within the halo as soon as this cooling time is smaller than the typical dynamical time. That's the rough idea. In fact, I mean, if you are fair, in order for those filaments to survive, you need to address other issues like Kelvin Helmholtz instability, because you have some inflowing gas here. You know, so you have a dense versus underdense interface that might turn unstable. You have a lot of different effects that might be taken into account. But this is a first-order estimation.
But they're dark matter confined, so what are instabilities wouldn't be right?
Sorry?
They're dark matter confined, so...
Yeah, you mean...
There's filaments that are dark matter dominated, so what are instabilities wouldn't be?
The dark matter, you mean the filament in the dark matter?
Well, the filaments in the dark matter exactly where the filaments in the gas.
Sure.
So they're confined by the dark matter.
Yeah, but the pressure that comes here is the pressure of the dark matter and the gas. It's not gas thermal pressure. It's also you have also filament in the dark matter, and you have the same argument that applies, except that the velocity dispersion, typical velocity dispersion in the filament, compared to the velocity dispersion in the halo.
No, so for the instability is actually
the Kelvin Helmholtz argument. You mean?
Well, then
instability
is
there
because it's actually technically confined.
Yeah.
I thought these two mechanisms work for different mass
objects,
right? Why is the
Wilhelm
mass the same in the capsule?
Because we choose on purpose at different epochs.
Oh, it's different redshifts.
Yeah. So it's redshift 4 and redshift 2.
Okay.
So the only thing that is different is the redshift here. Yeah. And the halos are different, of course, but they have the same virial mass.
So why are they gone based on the argument about us?
Because here the typical cooling time of these filaments is now longer than the dynamical time, and so they basically vanished because they are disrupted by satellite shocks, whatever. But if the cooling time is smaller, then they can survive. And
So why is the cooling time different than the two redshifts?
Because the density is much lower here than here. The typical, average density in the universe is a factor of 10 different. So the cooling time is much. So there are basically the shock which was sitting here now is more stable and has escaped all the way to the very radius. And the filaments which exist here now have disappeared.
The mass accretion timescales of the two halos similar?
Good question.
I mean, we did this much simpler. We said, look, in objects that merge a lot, you get a lot of turbulent heating. Mm-hmm. The turbulent heating is faster than the cooling, then it's going to look like on the right.
Yeah, but
turbulent heating is less.
I mean, turbulent heating can give you roughly this number, right?
That's right. It's just if you're in an isolated halo.
No, but there is an additional complexity here. That usually filaments occurs and stronger in halos which are at the intersection of filaments. That's a kind of tautology I'm saying. But those are isolated halo. I mean, if you are the same halo, but those are actually high sigma peaks also. Okay, so they are isolated, a lot of filaments are feeding them. If you take the same mass halo at earlier time, but which is not a high sigma peak anymore, well, this is still a high sigma peak, right? But if you take another small mass halo, then it won't be fed by a lot of filaments like that. So there is a clustering. There is a clustering difference.
What I'm arguing is sort of what we didn't like about this argument alone, because it just says it's only the cooling time. It's actually you probably apply the mass accretion rate of the whole system, the turbulent heating that goes into it.
Yeah, but the mass accretion rate is usually scaled like that, right? I mean, roughly. The thing that varies the most here is the cooling time.
Right, but you still get the same numbers for an isolated non-accreting rate.
Yes, I mean, as soon as you have filaments. Yeah, but the position of the halo and the fact that you have large-scale filaments going into it depends also on the clustering. That's what I'm saying.
The only stuff we're mentioning, big gas is controlled by something like a megaparsec.
Yeah, so this is co-moving megaparsec, right? Co-moving megaparsec. So what was your question?
I mean, it's a very large scale that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Star formation in big galaxies, that's the
idea. Yeah, well, basically, yeah. The idea is to say that what controls star formation in the average, as I say in the beginning of the talk, is diffuse gas accretion plus a delay related to star formation efficiency inside the disks. And here, maybe star formation shutdown, I mean, according to these people, me, might be also controlled by the geometry of the diffuse gas accretion around high redshift galaxies. So in order to be more quantitative about this the difference here, we have computed an interesting quantity, which is we call accretion-weighted histograms. So the idea is to actually consider a sphere at a given radius around the galaxy, and we compute the mass accretion rate, but as a function of the temperature and the metallicity or the density of the gas sitting here at the sphere and at a given direction around the galaxy. And so so we have several spheres like that, and we stack those spheres using our Hello catalog in order to draw some temperature versus metallicity here, accretion-weighted histogram. So in this way, we kind of estimate what is the dominant accretion flow as far as thermodynamics is concerned. And so this work was done also in Keres et al., but using a totally different approach because it's an SPH code, so they use a Lagrangian approach, while here it's more like a static analysis of the accretion around the galaxy. And so this is for stacking all spheres around 0.2 and 1 virial radius, and we use this as a proxy to detect the cold streams. Okay, and to detect the hot shocks, since those shocks are close, very close to the galactic disks, we use only the accretion-weighted histogram of the sphere sitting at 0.2 virial radius. So for the filaments, for the cold stream, what you get at Z equal 4 is basically a dominant accretion flow at low temperature here, lower than this typical threshold, and a subdominant accretion flow at high temperature. And if you go to redshift 2, 2.5 here, the situation is reversed. So now the dominant, so basically you see that all these mass that was sitting at low temperature has almost totally disappeared. What you catch here are, in fact, the direct surroundings of satellites, of clumpy satellites falling in. So this might be considered as a systematic effect in our estimation of the diffuse accretion. But you are dominated by hot accretion. Now 80% of the accreted mass in an accretion-weighted way is in the hot phase. And so if you actually compute those mass, so this is the fraction of mass as a function of Hallow mass. This is the fraction of mass in the cold phase and the fraction of mass in the hot phase at different redshifts. So each curve corresponds to a different redshift. Okay? So you see that each curve across here at 50% at a given mass, which is the critical mass, where the accretion goes from cold to hot, basically. In the filaments, so this is for the filament, for the cold stream, and this is the same for the hot shocks. So here, basically, you have no hot shocks, accretion-related gas, and here you have mainly hot shocks, accreted gas. Yes?
Is most of the cold gas being heat and turned into galaxy, or is it actually being variable?
Actually, here we compute everything which is between 1 and 0.2 virial radius. So the transition from here to here might be more subtle than just this curve suggests, because you can have the filament that actually start to disconnect from the very central galaxy while they still exist at higher radius. So in fact, it's more subtle than that. So here we are just capturing a typical evolution. What you see here is that the critical mass evolved a lot with redshift, while here it's kind of constant with redshift for the shock. So when you plot those critical mass as a function of redshift, so the red points are for the hot shocks and the blue points are for the cold stream, and you can actually see a very different evolution. So, I mean, where does the bimodality come from? For the existence of a shock or for the existence of a cold stream, we don't know. Actually, the very important point here is that the metallicity in this gas is critical, and the reason is simple, it's because of the cooling. And actually, if you use the very simple analytical model I have shown you before about the cooling times, you can actually estimate a critical mass for the shock, and this is this curve here. This was done by Dekele Birboin recently. And this is this curve here for a typical metallicity of 0.1 solar. And this is the cold stream mass for a metallicity of 0.1 solar. Okay. And now the same analytical estimate, but for a metallicity of 10 to minus 3 solar, very low metallicity, for the hot shocks and for the cold streams. And what we find, basically, in this simulation is, of course, related to the metallicity. So you see that the cold stream here have in average, a very low metallicity, which is of the order of 10 minus 3 solar. While the hot shocks, so I don't have the plot here, but the hot shocks are much closer to the disks, and so the metallicity is much higher, is 110 solar. So basically what we find here is that the hot shock critical mass is close to the high metallicity case, while the cold stream critical mass is close to the low metallicity case. And so now if you compare with observations, so this is a very tricky business, trying to estimate based on various approach like color magnitude diagram. So this is the Z equals zero critical mass here. Okay. Now people are trying to estimate this critical mass as a function of redshift. So it's kind of tricky, as you can imagine, but they come up with this strong evolution. So what means these results? Maybe it means that the Favor model, at least for observation, is not the presence or absence of a hot shock that determines the critical mass, but more the presence or absence of cold streams. Except we have a problem here, that those cold streams need to be highly enriched in order to fit the data, and which is not the case in our simulation. So this is maybe due to the fact that our winds are way too inefficient in order to enrich the interstellar medium. So that might explain the result. So I'm gonna stop here. Thank you.